Speak Synthesis, Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today, and thanks for listening to RBN. Please click on the word schedule in the RBN banner at the top of the page at republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest schedule for this program, please visit the radio schedule page at spingola.com. You may see a list of the guests together with links to their websites. Feel free to join my email list to receive a weekly announcement of the scheduled guest and other special notices. I have linked it to today's date. For questions or comments during the program, email spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna@spingola.com, which I do not access during the program. We will take calls later in the program, but please wait until I open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. I have thought a lot about today's program. Usually I attempt to treat all guests cordially and with respect both during and after a program. I maintain the theory that some lawyers employ in the courtroom when dealing with a witness. If an attorney verbally brutalizes a witness, even a guilty one, then the jury might sympathize with that witness. I would rather let the facts speak for themselves and allow the listeners to draw their conclusions from the information that I present on this program without regard to the character of the guest. I am in the western suburbs of Chicago. There's another Chicago suburb called Skokie, which is about a half-hour drive north of the city. I'm going to talk about one of the country's biggest brainwashing propaganda operations that people often associate with Skokie. That community has received national attention twice for court cases decided by the United States Supreme Court. In the mid-1970s, Skokie was at the center of a case concerning the First Amendment right to assemble and the National Socialist Party of America. Skokie ultimately lost that case. Some of the information that I acquired about the subject of my discussion came from a book, When the Nazis Came to Skokie, by Dr. Philippa Strum, currently a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. She received her education at Brandeis and Harvard Universities and grants and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the American Council of Learned Societies, the American Philosophical Society, and from the Fulbright Program. She is a former Broke Lundian professor of political science at the City University of New York. I am unsure of her ethnicity, but given that she promotes multiculturalism, gay rights, and other liberal Marxist ideas, I would conclude that she is a Jew. Dr. Strum would have been more accurate if she had named her book, When a Jew Came to Skokie Masquerading as a Nazi. While the small group was not composed of Jews, its leader was a Jew. Dr. Strum admits at the beginning of her book that this agitator's father was a Jew. She is quick to state that he was very distant from his father. The newspapers later claimed that he did the things that he did out of a deep-seated hatred for his father based on a psychiatrist's alleged interview of him. However, he appears to have lived in his parents' home at various times until he was 50 and is said to have visited them often. Okay, we're coming up on a break. We will be right back with our discussion about the Skokie March. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna. I don't have a guest today, and please remember, we will take calls later in the program, but wait until we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. German immigrants populated Skokie, originally called Niles Center, during the 19th century. Between 1937 and 1941, ethnic Germans created the Chicago German-American Bund and would, in their NSDAP uniforms, occasionally parade down one of Skokie's main streets. Thereafter, they would gather at Otto Decker's restaurant. New York Congressman Samuel Dickstein investigated and began harassing the Bund, calling it a subversive organization. Dr. William Pierce, while discussing the biased reporting by the History Channel, reported that Congressman Dickstein was a Soviet espionage agent who was actually on the payroll of the Soviet NKVD. Consequently, in the 1930s, this Jewish Soviet espionage agent, posturing as an American patriot, condemned the Bund as un-American. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, NKVD records revealed Dick Stein's role as an NKVD agent. Meanwhile, the Roosevelt administration and the Jewish-controlled media collaborated with Congressman Dick Stein in demonizing and incarcerating Fritz Kuhn, K-U-H-N, the Bund's chairman, on a fabricated embezzlement charge in 1939. Dr. Strum, in her writing of that same matter in her book, totally failed to mention Congressman Dick Stein's investigation and harassment of the group. And that explains, and rather explains that the Bund stopped all of their activities because the American media was, and I quote, carrying stories of Hitler's troops rampaging through Europe, and with the American military draft in place, the Nazis had stopped marching in Skokie, unquote. The implication here is that the Germans could not be trusted because, of course, they supported Hitler, who was allegedly destroying Europe, and that the United States could not count on them to put on a uniform and fight with America to stop that madman. Interestingly, one could possibly make a connection between those earlier marches and the later marches in Skokie, particularly since the Jews had displaced the earlier Germans. German officials incarcerated Max Simon Cohn, C-O-H-N, or I've also seen it spelled Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, a Jew in Dachau for 3 months, perhaps for some communist activity or some other illegal activity. Cohn relocated to Chicago and ultimately settled in Olympia Fields, a Chicago suburb. He and his wife had their first child on November 3, 1944, a son they named Francis Joseph Cohn, C-O-H-N, who, according to his birth certificate, was born in Chicago, Illinois. Francis, nicknamed Frank, had three younger siblings. In 1946, Max Simon Cohn changed his last name to Colin. Some people maintain that Frank Colin is not a Jew. However, Dr. Strum, in her book, states that the FBI discovered that his surname on his birth certificate was C-O-H-N, and that he was half Jewish, as his father Max was a Jew. As the old adage says, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. I favor the conspiratorial view of history. I do not believe that things just happen. Rather, my research leads me to understand that people plan things. Moving ahead more than a decade, it might be important to get a sense of the 60s. It was the decade of the Vietnam War, Golden Triangle drugs, sex, and rock and roll. Teeny boppers idolized gyrating male music personalities, many of whom had relatives with close connections to the intelligence network. The media gave CIA asset Gloria Steinem and her close associates, Betty Friedan and Bella Abzug, massive coverage for their growing women's movement that ultimately led to Roe versus Wade, which then led to almost 56 million infant deaths in the name of free choice. This was a decade of multiple CIA and Mossad assassinations. John F. Kennedy, who refused to sanction Israel's nuclear program, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Vietnamese President Hugo Diem, Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba, and UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. There's a multitude of other circumstances that drastically altered and demoralized our culture in the 60s. Hollywood has produced hundreds of Holocaust movies for the purpose of enslaving the minds of the Gentile public with guilt. They produced Sophie's Choice, while one could watch Hogan's Heroes on television, both designed to wholly misrepresent the German character. Publishers reprinted Miklos Nizeli's Auschwitz, A Doctor's Eyewitness Account, in time for Adolf Hitler's show trial, starting on April 11, 1961, in Israel. To legitimize Nicelli's work as more than the novel that it was, the second edition of the book, in 1961, had Eichmann's picture on the front. In 1966, Jean-François Steiner published his best-selling novel, Treblinka, promoted as an accurate history based on oral and written testimonies. In 1959, veteran former U.S. Navy Commander George Lincoln Rockwell had founded the World Union of Free Enterprise National Socialist. But a year later, he renamed it the American Nazi Party to attract maximum media attention. The party had its headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. In 1963, assuming that he left home before his November birthday, the 18-year-old Frank Cullen left Illinois and moved to Arlington, Virginia to join or perhaps to infiltrate Rockwell's party. Jews are very skilled at infiltrating movements. They can fool even the most educated and astute people. This includes Dr. William Pierce, who was initially impressed with Cullen and wanted him in the propaganda department because he apparently exhibited some aptitude in that area. Very few of the members liked Cullen. One of the staff leaders, Ralph Forbes, who thought that Cullen was a Jew and a queer, refused to train him and soon left the group. On January 1, 1967, Rockwell reorganized the party as the National Socialist White People's Party, the NSWPP. He based the party on the ideals and policies of Adolf Hitler's NSDAP in Germany during the Third Reich, but also expressed allegiance to the constitutional principles of America's founding fathers. The party also added a platform of Holocaust denial. On August 25th, 1967, someone assassinated Rockwell. Another assassination that we can put into that 1960s decade. By the end of 1968, Frank Cullen claimed to the press that he had differences with Rockwell's successor, Matt Cole, K-O-E-H-L. The party claimed it tossed Cullen out when he discovered the ethnic information on his birth certificate. He relocated to Chicago and began organizing the National Socialist Movement on December 1968. He would have been about 24 then. Reportedly, Cullen, along with a few thugs, showed up at the branch office of Rockwell's National Socialist White People's Party and found Lieutenant Bob Homan, a man in his mid-20s, was staffing the office by himself. At that time, the party was in the process of registering the building as NSWPP property. Cullen's accomplices allegedly roughed Homan up, and Cullen reportedly grabbed the relevant paperwork and soon registered the building in his name and gained control of the property. He then founded the National Socialist Party of America with headquarters in his newly acquired building. The media apparently viewed this new party as Rockwell's original party. Okay, I'm going to play a clip in just a few minutes. We'll probably do that after we come back from our break, which will be coming up momentarily. On April 16th, 1970, Cullen set up headquarters at 2519 West 71st Street. A house built in 1925 on Chicago's south side in the Marquette Park neighborhood, the largest park on the southwest side of Chicago. It is about 323 acres, and at that time it was a hotbed of racial and ethnic tensions, which was a very appropriate place to start trouble. And when tensions begin to mount, he was there and certainly participated in them. Let's see, we do have 1 minute. We'll wait until after the break. We'll wait until after the break. But, okay, so just to backtrack just a little bit, Frank Cullen left his home at the age of 18, and instead of going to school or getting a job or doing both, he immediately left home, presumably after his high school graduation, and went to Arlington, Virginia, where he joined Rockwell's party. And he apparently stayed there and worked in the party, perhaps because Ralph Forbes refused to train him in propaganda methods. Perhaps there was somebody else that took up that position. Anyway, that is where he stayed until 1968, December 1st, 1968, when he came back to Chicago and started his own party and managed somehow to take over the property of the Rockwell Party affiliate. All righty, we are going to a quick break. We will be back in 3 minutes, and then we'll listen to a couple of clips. We are going to do those clips right away with Audio One. It is a YouTube video, and we're just going to play a few minutes of that. Are we ready for Audio One? Okay. Listen
very carefully. The next Nazi leader came forth.
What were they arrested for? Dave?
Frank Collin emerged from Rockwell's shadow in 1970 when he formed the National Socialist Party of America.
Attention, please.
His group was also small in numbers, but Collin's goals were lofty. And during the early 1970s, he led his troops on a racial rampage through the Chicago suburbs.
I just see myself as a soldier. That's the way I look at myself. A soldier who is doing his duty to his Führer and his commander. I believe that Adolf Hitler prepared the philosophy of National Socialism, which is nothing more than white unity, actually. And that Commander Rockwell told us how to make it work here in America. Both those men gave their lives for that idea, and I figure I'm just following orders.
In 1977, Collin's party rose to national prominence when it harassed the Jewish community of Skokie, Illinois, all the way to the United States Supreme Court. It was called the Skokie Right to March case, and its challenge to the First Amendment threatened an entire community. Collin embraced controversy. He had been harassing blacks and Jews in the Chicago area for years. Collin conducted over 40 pro-Nazi speeches in the Chicago parks between 1971 and 1975, with only one resulting in violence and arrest. But in 1977, the city banned him from the parks, and Collin went in search of another venue. In 1978, Frank Collin announced his intentions of marching his Nazi party through the streets of Skokie, Illinois. He chose Skokie because it was the most populated Jewish city per capita in America. The residents of the city refer to Skokie as a village, and the unusual camaraderie of its residents was due to the high concentration of Holocaust survivors that lived there. Collin's announcement to march in Skokie shocked the Jewish community nationwide.
You could feel tension coming from every segment, every Jewish community across this country. Skokie literally became the cause célèbre for Jewish people. These people were the remnant.
All righty. Thank you so much. Now, it's very interesting. This was a segment on the History Channel, what some people call the Hitler Channel. And they presented their view, but never once stated that Frank Collin may have been a Jew. Of course, we know that the media is very selective in order to program our perceptions. And going back to when Frank Collin may or may not have gone to Arlington, in some places, in the book, specifically in the book by Dr. Strum, she said that he went in 1963, right out of high school, and he may have been there for a few months, or he may have been there longer. So it's not, you know, it just depends on what source that you happen to look at. And he really did not start the NSPA until he got the headquarters building. And but he was certainly organizing his forces. Okay, now we are going to listen to audio two, and this is from 6/21, Thursday, 6/21. Okay, we're ready with that that audio.
About 100 years ago.
It is interesting. I mean, we know that often people will conceal their own background for various reasons, but for a body of educators, so-called educators, to conceal or attempt to dismiss or marginalize discoveries that might make us and basically these discoveries would make us question our own history and culture.
Not only that, they'd make us question also the people that have told us for all these generations that all this is a bunch of nonsense. So they cannot admit that even one piece of evidence is legitimate because their entire ivory tower would collapse. Now, that's how fragile they are. If they were to admit that the Kensington Rune Stone is in fact legitimate, as it is, that would bring into question all this other evidence, this huge body of evidence, which shows that there were people from Northern Europe, from Western Europe, even from West Africa, that made impacts on Mexico, certainly from Japan. All this would flood in and completely dismantle their paradigm, and that's why they have to resist it.
Certainly. Now, speaking of education, what is your educational background? Are you university trained? How did you come to this knowledge of, was it through experience, the archaeological knowledge?
Yes, it was through experience. I went to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and I was going there as a history minor and as a journalism major. And this place that I mentioned earlier, the Monk's Mound, Cahokia, across the Mississippi River, is something that I visited by accident. I was already a junior at the university, and I had heard absolutely nothing. None of my professors told me anything about Cahokia, which was about an hour and a half's drive away. And I just happened to visit it one day by accident because there was so much traffic building up on the expressway. I was going to St. Louis just to have fun. We'd go there on the weekends just to enjoy the city. And I got off the expressway to see what these Indian mounds were. I thought, just some little heaps of earth. I'm standing before this gigantic pyramid straight out of either Egypt or Mesopotamia. And I went back to my history professor. I said, how come you never told us about this? He said, well, it's not really as significant as you think, he told me.
Oh. All that dirt. All right. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
ImpUSA.org today.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted...
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and I'm discussing the Skokie March, when tensions mounted in the summers of 1976 and 1977. The Martin Luther King Jr. Coalition and a group of Chicago African Americans attempted to especially confront Colin by marching in Marquette Park. Colin prepared by putting a sign on the side of what he called Rockwell Hall, and it said, N-I-G-G-E-R, comma, go home. Brick-throwing angry teenagers confronted about 100 coalition members when they marched in Marquette Park in July 1976. Agitators injured 33 people, while the police arrested 63, including some members of Colin's group. After the Martin Luther King Coalition had marched in Marquette Park, Colin found that the Chicago Park District required a group to post between $100,000 and $300,000 in public liability insurance, in addition to a $50,000 bond against property damage in order to hold a march. Not having that kind of money, Colin contracted the Illinois branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. The ACLU ultimately would persuade a federal court to strike down three ordinances that placed significant restrictions on the Nazis' First Amendment right to march and express their views. Colin recognized that the only way he could call attention to his cause was to get media coverage, which Bob Green was happy to provide to the many readers of the Chicago Sun-Times. Colin told Green that he intended to target, for potential marches, certain northern suburbs in which large numbers of Jews lived. Colin and his group produced a pamphlet entitled, We Are Coming, complete with a swastika and a caricature of a stereotypical Eastern European Jew. He included the following statements in his pamphlet. And I quote, where one finds the most Jews, there one will find the most Jew haters. We want to reach the good people, get the fierce anti-Semites who have to live among the Jews to come out of the woodwork and stand up for themselves, unquote. He wanted to frighten the Jews. He said, and I quote, I hope they're terrified. I hope they're shocked because we're coming to get them again. I don't care if someone's mother or father or brother died in the gas chambers. The unfortunate thing is not that there were 6 million Jews who died. The unfortunate thing is that there were so many Jewish survivors, unquote. According to Strum, Collins' core group of followers consisted of only about 24. According to Strum, 24 uniformed followers. The main activity of Frank Collins' National Socialist Party of America in the 1970s was organizing loud demonstrations against blacks moving into previously all-white neighborhoods. The marches and community reaction led the city of Chicago to ban all demonstrations in Marquette Park unless they paid that insurance fee of $250,000. At that point in time, Harold Covington was the number two leader under Colin, a position that he held from 1976 until 1980. Colin also organized marches in other suburbs north of Chicago. The media always covered his group's activities while ignoring Rockwell's successor and that party's activities. With the help of David Goldberger, a staff attorney for the Illinois ACLU, Colin used the court system to exert power and win the right to march where he wanted. In June 1976, a federal district court judge in Chicago found the city's requirement of a parade insurance bond to be unconstitutional in a case brought by the Illinois ACLU on behalf of Frank Collin. Okay, we're going to have audio three, and so if Dan, our man in the control room, would play that, that would be super. Now, I'm assuming that Frank Joseph is your name. You're not using a pen name?
No, that's it.
So Joseph is the surname that you were born with?
Yes.
Okay. What did you do before 1993? Were you associated with this field? Were you in what did you do?
Well, I worked in a number of newspapers. I worked mostly magazines.
Okay, we have just a little technical difficulty, but we will okay, now we don't have a technical difficulty. Okay, we're back.
Your proposed march into Skokie has generated a lot of controversy here in Chicago, United States, and matter of fact, on an international scale. Could you just outline the genesis of this march that you proposed?
Well, there's a theme or a slogan which we in the party have used as regards Skokie, and that is, the path to Marquette Park leads through Skokie. The reason is since 1975, we have been banned from speaking in Marquette Park, where we have the greatest support amongst the white masses, the white working class and the white youth. We've also been banned from speaking in all of the northern suburbs of Illinois and all of the other parks throughout Chicago and much of the nation. The only way that we can seek to remedy this is through the courts, and we've been fighting in the courts for our right to free speech now since 1975, for 2.5 years, going on 3 years now, unsuccessfully. Every time we take the case to court, it's heard by a Jewish or a Negro judge who either does not rule and keeps the case going, or else who rules against us. We decided in 1977 that we would dramatize the fact that First Amendment rights for National Socialists have been denied. And the only way that could be done was to force the issue in an area where the concept of white power or National Socialism was most opposed, that being Skokie, which has a large Jewish population. There's another reason also. We believe that it is primarily the Jewish people, through the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, their most powerful organization, which has put pressure on groups like the Chicago Park District to keep us from speaking.
So in marching into Skokie, we not only put pressure on the idea of First Amendment rights for National Socialists, but we also helped to identify those people who are preventing us from being heard by the masses of white people. And Skokie also is a testing case. We knew we'd get a tremendous amount of hysterical reaction there, that it would be a very hard struggle, that we would have to go into court. But in so going to court, we would establish our legality. We've known for years that the Jews would like to ban us altogether, not just from speaking, but from existing. And by piling up one Supreme Court decision after another, we would establish our legality, and it would then be very difficult for them to outlaw us. We want to remain a public organization above ground. We don't want to be forced underground into terrorism. We want to remain open. So the whole idea behind Skokie is to put pressure on the system, on the courts, by piling up these Supreme Court decisions to get our rights back in Marquette Park, and also to propel into the vision of the entire...
All righty. Now, that tape does end kind of abruptly. I find it most interesting that he would use the word terrorism, as terrorism has been used by that particular a particular group of people, especially in Russia, back in the 1860s. So I find that very interesting. Now, after World War II, a sizable Jewish population settled in Skokie, Illinois, about, as I said before, a half hour from Chicago. It was originally a German-Luxembourger farming community. By the mid-60s, 40% of the population was Jewish, the largest percent of any Chicago suburb. By 1977, about 70,000 residents lived in Skokie. There is no official way of determining religiosity. However, Jack Mabley, a Chicago Tribune reporter, noted that there were 26 houses of worship in 1977. One Baptist, three Lutheran, three Catholic, one Assembly of God, two Presbyterian, one Bible Church, one Christian Scientist, one Suburban Christian, one Methodist, one Baha'i, I'm not sure what that is, one Episcopalian Church, one United Christ of Church, and nine synagogues. So one official estimated that there were about 30,000 Jews living in Skokie. Well, another official thought that there might be as many as 40,500. On October 4th, 1976, Frank Collins sent letters to park districts in the northern suburbs of Chicago asking for permission to demonstrate. He received a reply from Skokie officials saying that they required a posting of a $350,000 bond. On March 20th, 1977, Frank Collins wrote to the Skokie Park District telling them that the NSPA plans to demonstrate on May 1st, a very interesting date, claiming that the bond requirement violates the First Amendment. Collins could now claim that Skokie officials were keeping him from exercising his constitutional rights because of insurance requirements. On March 20, 1977, Collins wrote back to the Skokie Chief of Police, Kenneth B. Chamberlain, announcing that the NSPA planned to demonstrate on May 1st, claiming that the bond, again, violates his First Amendment. In 1977 and 78, the National Socialist Party of America decided to organize a march in Skokie, quite a distance from its headquarters on Chicago's north side, because one in six Skokie residents was allegedly a Holocaust survivor. Local officials opposed the march, which would surely prove very disruptive. Therefore, they withheld permission to the NSPA. However, that Jewish lawyer with the ACLU interceded in behalf of the NSPA against the village, against the village of Skokie. The Cook County Circuit Court judge issued, an injunction ruling that the presence of a swastika would constitute a deliberate provocation against the people of Skokie. Yet the court ruled that Skokie's attorneys had failed to demonstrate that the Nazi uniform and the printed materials that the group planned to distribute would incite violence. In 1987, Skokie would erect a Holocaust monument. Now, this is all very interesting. In April 1980, authorities convicted Frank Collins for sexually molesting two young boys. After his release from Pontiac State Prison as a convicted pederast, he became a published author, editor, and now writes articles on ancient archaeological artifacts for The Ancient American. He dropped his previous surname, and we'll need that audio momentarily, audio four. He dropped his previous surname and currently uses his given names, Frank Joseph. In 1999, when Dr. Strum wrote her book, she claimed that Frank Collin had never traveled outside of the United States. Okay, let's have that audio. I'm assuming that Frank Joseph is your name. You're not using a pen name?
No, that's it.
So Joseph is the surname that you were born with?
Yes.
Okay. What did you do before 1993? Were you associated with this field? Were you what did you do?
Well, I worked in a number of newspapers. I worked mostly magazines. I also spent a lot of time doing research. I had an opportunity to travel around the world several times. What I did mostly is I worked as a motorcycle courier, and I saved all my pennies, and I would go on these long trips around the world. And the research that I collected by going to Polynesia and North Africa and Western Europe, I've been able to put into my books since then.
And you paid for all of these trips yourself?
I paid for them all myself. Like I said, I worked as a motorcycle courier in Chicago. I worked at a place called Deadline Express. As a matter of fact, I guess I can say that because I don't think they exist anymore. You don't see many motorcycle couriers anymore, come to think of it. Too dangerous, I suppose. Some of us did get killed, as it turns out. When I worked as a motorcycle courier, I saved my money, and then you read so much, you really have to go and visit these places to sort of verify with your own physical experience if what you're seeing, what you're reading about is correct. Because anytime you read something, you're mostly reading somebody else's opinion.
Alrighty. Because we are going to the break, we will pick this up on the other side of the break. But it's very interesting that he has such a that Frank Collin has such an interesting history, and let's do a little bit of a recap. I find it very interesting, first of all, that he brought up terrorism, like I said before, but I find it very interesting that the ACLU, which it has recently banned so many Christian activities in this country, has banned and seems to pick and choose who they're going to fight for and what they're going to fight for. They will fight for somebody that ostensibly was a Nazi, and yet they will not fight for Christians to be able to pray in school or something of that nature. And so I find it very interesting also that the courts would also stand behind him. Now, you know, he only had 24 men, and for such a small group, when you consider the size of the various groups that the ACLU has fought against, whose First Amendment rights are also important, and yet here's this little dinky group of 24 men, and somehow they have the ACLU come in and intercede in their behalf. Now, as a result of them doing this, they did lose a lot of members. But because of the circumstances and because of what it produced, they got a lot of members, replacement members. Now, it's also interesting, whenever you look at any operation, whenever you look at any event, you have to ask the question, who benefits and who loses? And obviously, the benefactors of this Skokie or this attempted march in Skokie by a couple of dozen people claiming to be Nazis benefited the Jews. It benefited the whole idea of the Holocaust. Because remember, in his words, he states categorically what he thought about the 6 million and the gas chambers. So he reinforced that idea. Okay, we're going to a break. We'll finish listening to the tape. When we come back, stay tuned.
That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com.
Love becomes a defiant, out-of-control child who disrespects you. That's why my husband James and I created the Total Transformation, the program that tens of thousands... I'm willing to give away 1,000 programs today for free.
Are going to listen to the last part of that audio. So, Dan, you want to play that?
Of course. Even the most unbiased and objective person that puts their own bias into it. So by traveling to the extent that I did, I traveled for about 12 years.
Oh, my goodness. Now,
yeah.
how long were you a courier?
I was a courier from, I think, 1985 until for about 10 years till 1995, because in 1995 I left Chicago and I settled in St. Paul, where I was a marketing director for a publishing house.
Okay, so you didn't actually, and you also joined the magazine Ancient American in 1993.
Well, it wasn't anything to join back then. Wayne May suggested that we started, and so we worked on it together, and we created the first issues, and we've been together ever since.
Right. And so what did you do before 1985?
Well, like I say, before 1995, I was a courier. I was a courier from 1985 to 95, and my chief job then was, I felt I was a student. I was consumed with these questions, and there wasn't any place you could really go to learn these things. So I just read and read and took my notes, and all I could think about was someday writing these wonderful things up after I had learned more about them. And
right.
I began traveling in 80, well, actually I began traveling even earlier than that, 83 I guess it was, I began my first trips to Mexico. So I've been to so many places I can't have to stop and think all the places
right.
I've been.
So what did you do before 1983 as a profession?
Well, 1983, I was writing. I was doing magazine articles. I've been a writer all my life. I finished my education in the 70s, and so I worked mostly as as freelancing. I worked at a couple of small magazines.
Okay, so from the time you graduated in 1970s to 1983, you were a independent writer?
Mm-hmm, that's correct. Yeah, freelance, uh-huh.
Okay.
And then, of course, you don't make much money as a freelance writer, that's for sure. Not enough to travel. So that's when I figured, well, I'm going to have to get some money somehow. And I figured the best way to do that was to risk my life by delivering architect's plans and other stranger things than that.
Sure. So you weren't married at this time that you were?
No, I wasn't. I couldn't be married at that time. My wife wouldn't allow me to get on a motorcycle today.
Right. Now, inasmuch as the first part of this book is about physical evidence, you do believe that these ancient artifacts provide scientific evidence that absolutely trumps popular, long-held, accepted beliefs. And there are many other areas in which people have readily accepted theories because of their pervasive media popularity. So do you think that the media, and you've already indicated what you think of the educational system, but do you think that the media can drive the so-called vehicle that makes us all believe things that really aren't true?
Well, I believe that's exactly the case. I think that every time I turn on the television, I feel like I'm looking at toxic waste. I don't really think that the media serves, well, that's an entire different subject, I suppose, but my opinion of the media in general is extremely low. And I feel it is a complete cultural failure, put it that way. Total, absolute cultural failure.
Certainly.
One example I can give of that is after Scott Walter has spent, I don't know how many thousands of dollars and tens of thousands of dollars of his own money and his time, his expertise on the Kensington Runestone.
All righty. We will be back after a station ID. Stay tuned.